Right, so Natasha asked me to talk for the rest of the afternoon. So I will be a bit more selective. So I'll start talking about some very basic things, which probably all of you know. And then I will show you that those basic things don't work. And then I will talk a lot about angular momentum. And more about angular momentum. And then my time will probably be up. Unless I have some time, and if I have some time, I may talk about things like wind flow, shrub overflow, and circumbinding disks, some of the recent topics in binary disk theory. A couple of things I will not talk about at all. One is common envelope evolution, because Natasha will talk about that. And I decided not really to talk about irradiation effects in binaries, in particular, that could be important in X-ray binaries, black hole binaries, millisecond pulsars. I think that's a useful topic, which we may want to have some power discussion at some point during this evening. But it will just be too much. Okay, don't need to explain this. It's just the Roche potential. And, it's the concept of Roche lob overflow is you have one of the objects filling its Roche lob, and then you can transfer mass to the companion system. Now, that's not the reason why I show it to you. I show it to you because this is the inner Lagrange point. There are two outer Lagrange points that are also important. And if the system fills one of these equipotential surfaces, then the system, the material, can no longer remain in co-rotation, and there's an outward fork. So what happens if the system gets bigger than the equipotential that goes through these outer Lagrangian points? Well, the binding itself can no longer remain in co-rotation, and one thing that can happen is you can get a spiral in, and that will then can start a common envelope phase. Alternatively, if you lose that material, it will carry away a lot of angular momentum, and that will drive the evolution of the system, and I will show you later how. Yeah, please interrupt me at any point. This is a co-rotating frame, yes. It's a co-rotating frame. Right. Now, there are many people who don't like binaries. And the reason why they don't like binaries is because they say you can do anything you like with binaries. I strongly object to that view. Because there's still physics, and the same stellar physics that applies to single stars also applies to binaries. Moreover, we actually have lots of observational constraints. There are many, I've just listed a few classes of binary systems that tell us a lot about mass transfer, and as I will show you in a few minutes, tell you that some of the simple ideas cannot be right. And so you're not in a physics-free space, and one of the things I like doing is actually trying not only to understand the different types of binaries, but trying to connect them. For example, there is a connection between certain types of hot subdwarfs and symbiotic binaries. And in principle, if we understand how these different types of systems connect, we actually really understand the evolution of binaries. We'll not do that here, but I'll just mention it. Okay, now starting with the general introduction. These are things you would all have heard. We know observationally that most stars are members of binary systems. Of course, a large fraction of them are not in interacting binaries, particularly at the lower mass end. But still, even the lower mass end, something like 30 to 50% of stars are in binaries that are close enough that they will interact at some point during the evolution. For the more massive stars, it's even more dramatic. And the recent work by Yuxana showed that as many as 70% of all stars may be close enough that they will interact during the evolution. So, as Elliot was talking about yesterday, binary effects are not is not the exception, it's actually the rule for the massive stars.
What about the triple fraction?
Well, the triples are, as I would say, the new binaries. I mean,
everybody, you can do everything with them.
They get bored with them, yes. However, you can no longer ignore them. Right? The estimate now is that there are enough triples that you may actually have an interaction with all three stars. And that fraction, people quote as 10%.
Pardon? I was just wondering about getting 1A's out of triples.
Oh, the paper, that paper has already been written.
No, no, three together. I mean, three together.
Oh.
Oh, just two. Sorry. Three-way
collision. There is a triple type 1A paper, so you know that. Then. Not one other quote. Okay. Now, the other thing, just general nomenclature, is, well, when do stars start mass transfer? That depends, of course, on the orbit separation and the radius evolution of stars. This is for five solar mass stars showing the radius evolution. And you know, in the main sequence, where it spends most of its time, it expands by a factor of 2. So we have a fairly narrow period range in which the system can then start to transfer mass. After the main sequence, it crosses the Hertzsprung gap, expands by a factor of more than 10, and there's a large probability that the system will encounter a mass transfer phase in that phase. Then, after helium burning, it may expand again, and depending on in which phase mass transfer happens, we call these case A, B, or C. Now, I should point out, this is for five solar mass stars. There's a, if the period distribution is constant in log P, these would be the probabilities of having case A, B, and C mass transfer. Now, for more massive stars, this range is much smaller. And in fact, for the most massive stars, there may be no case C mass transfer. But this itself will depend on the metallicity. It's shown here by Stephen, but I will not talk about that. You know, all know there are two basic types of mass transfer. One is just stable mass transfer, where you have one star transferring mass to the companion star. And if this mass transfer is conservative, then the system tends to widen. Now, how does the structure of the two stars change? Well, the mass-losing star will lose mass till it has basically lost most of its envelope. So it's a hydrogen-rich star. It mass transfer ends when it has transfers most of the hydrogen and then is essentially a helium star. It may still have some hydrogen left, but not much. The accreting star will also be affected, depending, and this depends on when the accretion occurs. If it occurs in the main sequence, then the star is basically rejuvenated. The convective core tends to grow, and it then behaves like a more massive star. If it's after the main sequence, then the core envelope structure changes, but I will not talk about that. The other type of mass transfer is this unstable mass transfer, and that typically occurs when the donor star is a red giant and the mass ratio is bigger than 1. The reason for that is that if you have a red giant star, if it loses mass very rapidly, it tends to expand. On the other hand, I'm going to show you this explicitly a little later, if the mass ratio is bigger than 1, so the donor star is more massive than companion star, the Roche-Loeb radius tends to shrink. And that's an inherently unstable situation. The radius wants to expand, but the critical radius, the Roche-Loeb radius, decreases, and that leads to runaway mass transfer. That's usually referred to as dynamical mass transfer. This is what can initiate the common envelope phase. This is not the only case when you may get... Yeah, sure, sorry.
So on the left, you say for the stable mass transfer that it's largely conservative.
Right.
Is that a statement that it is conservative or that it could be conservative? Do we know that it usually
is? We know it's not generally conservative. I will talk a lot about that later.
Okay.
That's when things become complicated.
Yeah.
But you know, when people talk about stability, they consider conservative mass transfer first because...
Right. I know that's what's normally done. I'm asking is
I'll talk a lot about this
what
later.
There is or what nature is.
Well, in there are observation constraints, and we know in many systems, for example, in algol binaries, mass transfer must be quite non-conservative, just from the properties of the algols, peer distributions. There are other systems that seem to be quite conservative. So I think it can either of that happen.
And do we understand why?
No. Not, well, there's nobody here.
Well, in the case of the algol binaries.
There's nobody. He's worked a lot on this.
In the case of the algol binaries, you've got radiation pressure driving these things. I don't know about cool binaries, but those would have mass transfer negations. No mass transfer.
Say again?
The accreting star is a hot star.
Sure.
So it drives its own wind, which could
yes,
be
of course.
Through the
accreting star. Yeah. I'll come, non-conservative mass transfer is one of the big topics of my talk, so I'll come back to that. Yeah.
I may have missed you saying it. Could you remind us what conservative actually means?
No mass is lost in the system.
No mass and no angular momentum.
Okay.
I will actually explain in more detail later.
Two properties are conservative.
Very conservative. Yeah, but please don't ask these questions because. Now, the other reason why you can get a common envelope is just because the accreting star may not be able to accept all the matter. Because the accreting star itself can only accrete at its own thermal time scale. And if it's much lower in mass, then the thermal time scale will be much longer. And what then happens is then the accreting star would tend to grow. And it will grow till the thermal time scale of the accreting star, the envelope of the accreting star, is comparable to the mass transfer time scale. This is also by Kippenhahn and Meyer-Hoffmeister. And so what they show here is a two solar mass star accreting at different rates.
You have to read it, blow it up a bit.
So at different accretion rates.
How did you do that?
That's just a PDF that you just zoomed in on.
Ah, okay. It's a PDF.
That was an excellent move.
Yeah.
That's a nice thing about
PDF. You can't do that on PowerPoint?
Okay.
Anyway, the point here is, you see, depending on the accretion rate, the star will expand. It's an HR diagram. And so if the Grosjean rate is, let's say, somewhere here, then for this accretion rate, the accreting star would not fill its Grosjean, but for this high accretion rate, it would. And so the system then would also go into some type of contact configuration, where you overfill both Grosjean lobes. And this is actually quite common for case B mass transfer for massive stars. And what happens in that case is not clear. There's a whole topic, what happens to the accreting star, which I will not cover. Norbert Lange has worked a lot on this, from some of their calculations. And again, it might be an interesting topic for some separate discussion. Okay, now let's talk about symbiotic binaries. Now, symbiotic binaries the types I'm talking about are stars where the donor star is a red giant and the accreting star is a white dwarf. This is a distribution of their properties. This shows the orbital period distribution. And you see the typical orbital period is in the range of 200 to perhaps 2,000 days.
And Philip, is that the sort of observational state of the art, just in terms of the numbers of these systems?
Well, this is 2010, but there have been a few more since then. But
basically, it's handfuls of systems that have been.
Well, not a handful, quite a lot.
The chance is huge.
Big handful.
It's a couple of hands.
Track that enthusiastic.
Five
hands.
Over 100.
Yeah. So over 100. Now, we know quite a bit, lot about them. You can study them quite well. We know also their masses. There's a mass estimate for the donor stars, and that's for the white dwarf. And there are several surprises. First, the mass ratios are usually quite large. They're usually 2 to 3. Now, this is surprising because if you have such a large...
Is there any symbiotics in K2? Has somebody measured these masses?
Has someone in K2?
Getting the mass of a red giant's hard because the radius tells you nothing about the mass.
So no.
What are these masses infer?
These are dynamical masses. I mean, many of them are
so
double. Yeah, some of them eclipsing.
Do you know if there's any S-type symbiotic star in K2 that somebody's gotten a seismic mass for? That would be a nice confirmation.
What's the white dwarf masses then?
Not the Hall?
Yeah. So I mean, there are these two exceptions. I will come to these two exceptions.
The mass ratio will be at least two.
Yeah. I just know it's hard to get masses of giants.
Right, but yeah, that's true. But these are dynamical masses.
Okay.
And some of them are eclipsing. Now, they are mass transferring systems. And an interesting point is that many of them show ellipsoidal light curve variations. CI Cygni, BF Cygni, and so on. What that means is that the donor star is tidally distorted. And you only get tidal distortions if these objects are very close to filling the Roche lobes. In fact, these objects have to be within 10% of filling the Roche lobes.
But they're wind-fed?
Well, that's the question.
Okay.
That is the question.
The thing about wind-fed, you know it concretely it was now changed. I mean, we say that it's at least 1.6, and we go for 3.
Yeah, right. We will talk about that tomorrow.
Still, it's not yet colorable.
I mean, in the simple picture, which I was alluding to earlier, you would have expected them to be dynamically unstable. And then the mass transfer phase would be very short. It would be unlikely for them to be in that system. In fact, what you see in this figure here is the mass loss rate of the red giant. You know, you see it as a stellar wind. And if you just take a standard model and let it evolve till it fills the Roche lobe, see the mass loss rate runs away at this point. And this, we would then say, leads to a common envelope, if that were the whole picture. The phase in which it goes through the M dots that are observed, sort of in the range of 10 to minus 8 to 10 to minus 6 solar masses for the accreting star, would be very short-lived. It would be a few thousand years. Now, in order to produce all the observed symbiotics, you would need an enormous number of symbiotics. Now, various solutions, and come back to the winds later, but one of the simple solutions might actually be that to take into account that these red giants actually have extended envelopes. Their observation have extended envelopes. If you take that into account, if you have an extended envelope that's 10% of the radius, this is the evolution you get. In this case, it still would run away, but it spends almost 10 to 5 years in this phase where it would look like a symbiotic.
Would you expect that identical outcome if it was a 0.5 solar mass main sequence star instead of a 0.5 solar mass white dwarf? Would you care for this theory?
In this particular calculation, that matters a little bit because in this calculation it actually doesn't matter. In this one it doesn't matter.
Right. I think your calculation doesn't care.
Right? No, no, I'm just wondering whether we should lose the mass or not.
Yeah.
That's what I'm worried about.
Oh,
that's the difference between the white dwarf and the...
Yeah.
But otherwise, to lowest order, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's just the point mass, the component.
Right.
Philip, can you remind us what observational diagnostics tell us a star is a symbiotic?
Okay. Symbiotic is a star that has the features of a red object and a blue object.
Okay.
And indeed, in the 80s, even the early, even the mid 80s, some people were arguing that these could be single stars. And then in the early 80s, people like Joanna Michajewska actually found out that all of them are binary systems. And so you get a red component from the giant, mm-hmm. and you get the blue component from the accreting white dwarf. It's not always clear, by the way, whether it's a white dwarf or main sequence star. There are arguments about that in many cases.
So a critical element of this argument is the time scales, and I'm just trying to understand, so part of my ignorance,
yes.
but I'm just trying to understand yes. just what the, like how well surveyed the galaxy is for these systems, and whether we have some complete knowledge within some bubble, so how seriously should we take that?
I think it's a factor of 100 discrepancy.
Sure.
And I would say that's very significant. But you're absolutely right. We don't know all the symbiotics in the galaxy. So we only know a subset, and so the numbers of symbiotics is based on correcting for selection effects. So there are selection effects there. They're significant. But they are not a factor of 100. Basically, if it's a factor of 100, then basically all stars would have to go through this phase.
Right.
And that's not likely.
Yes? So are you going to allude to what an extended atmosphere is?
Yes. No, I thought I was... No. I'm just assuming that the atmosphere is 10% of the radius of the star. Right? Because if you look at giant stars, and they tend to have extended density structures, not hard boundaries you get from stellar evolution calculations.
But so Lars's point about if this is just a main sequence star, then is it crazy?
No, this is a giant.
No, I understand. I understand. Yeah, you can get a symbiotic, like if observationally something could be a symbiotic.
It wouldn't be called a symbiotic if it were a main sequence star.
Yeah. It wouldn't have the blue.
It
wouldn't be blue enough. It wouldn't be blue enough, is the point.
It wouldn't be hot enough to give
you. Oh, if this is a main sequence, this is a main sequence.
No, it
would still be called a symbiotic.
Sorry?
It's still called symbiotic if this is a main sequence.
Not with the same mass, right? A 0.75 solar mass main sequence.
If you're red.
It would just be too red, so observationally it wouldn't be classified. I'm just trying to probe your comment about all stars going through this phase. So if you have lots of unequal mass systems where you would get,
there are arguments in many symbiotics whether the accreting star is actually main sequence star or not. So this is not so clear, including Myra.
Yeah.
Which I think he's a white dwarf. I mean, you have worked in Myra, so.
Yeah. It's a white dwarf.
I think he's a white dwarf.
How do we not know, though? Given it's. You mean it could be a very old, cold white dwarf? Is that the argument?
No, it's hot. It's pretty.
The effect of temperatures, it's so different.
I mean, you see mainly the inner parts of the disk, right? Looks an inner part of a disk at these temperatures looks like a star. It's not that obvious.
So I just really want to say that. I mean, this critical 1.1 is really, really low. I mean, we show that it's 1.603.
Yeah.
And that may solve all the problem of symbiotic stars. If you consider not instantaneous criterion for the stability, but if you try to consider the stream in the L1 neighborhood, then you can take instantaneously all the mass which is there, but you are limited by the stream rate, then your criterion just goes up. And that's even in the case of fully conservative masses.
That's another way of solving it. When CA Cygni is a mass ratio of 3, there are some that have a mass ratio of 4. But, fine. I'm not saying that that's the only solution.
So in your case, it's actually...
But you will talk about that tomorrow.
I'm saying I'm going to be okay. All right, go ahead.
I still have one remark, so atmospheres. I think, don't we have a very similar problem in the supergiant high mass X-ray binaries?
Mm-hmm.
There are also many more there than we should have.
Yeah, and, it's
a very similar situation. And there we think that with inflated envelopes of mass donors, we can somehow get around it. So maybe similar solutions.
Yeah. But you even have even bigger, even more extended envelopes there, right?
Oh, it depends, but that's why I'm still not sure I understand what an extended atmosphere is, because I probably don't have giant structure well enough to...
Do you think for an isolated one solar mass red giant in our sun, there's a mystery about extended material?
I think there are extended atmosphere, yeah. I think that's absolutely
evidence. Any evidence of that whatsoever comes out of that same material. The log G...
How would you know that? How would you get that from the seismology?
The log G is from astral size. I mean, it's not a radius.
So, can we just define? I don't even understand now what extended envelope means. This is something outside the photosphere.
If you calculate densities function, right? Get that, and then that's what you get if you calculate, if you have a sharp boundary construct. Okay. What I call an extended envelope is something like that.
No stellar model has a jump like this. I mean,
so I'm exaggerating.
It's optically thick.
Right. My point is the stellar model has a sharp boundary condition, which is not real.
But aren't many of these mass transfer schemes thought out thinking that you have an extended atmosphere? So I mean, sure. All this work from Ritter.
Yeah, that's what we assume.
Oh, okay, so that's what you said.
That's what we assume,
back?
Yeah.
Okay,
that's what we assume. M dot is proportional to some number, and e to the minus some radius difference over some scale up. The Ritter formulas. Right? And so what I'm doing here is I'm increasing this by a factor of 10 compared to what you calculate at the surface boundary.
Okay, but I guess my question is, are you attributing that to the fact that there's a hot companion nearby? So you think that's true in isolation?
Yes.
I have no idea what the data is.
There's people who look at the chromospheres of red giants and they argue that they are atmospheres.
Yeah, so the hydro models of the atmosphere of red giants, right? So we have enough information to that this is not a mystery. We know how the structure of the giant atmosphere looks like.
I don't think that's really true, because I mean, what we don't even know what drives the mass loss in the red giant. And it's that what I would associate is connected with the extended envelope. That's what I would think that.
That's why I was a little bit confused when you showed this diagram here. Mm-hmm. What is it? Two different M dots. One of them is a wind.
It's this is the mass loss from the donor star, which has a stellar wind. But
it's not
at this point.
Stellar wind mass loss.
That's
it's not the stellar wind mass.
That is the stellar wind mass loss initially, yes. But here, it gets close enough that this formula gives us the runaway M dot.
But the general problem
approaches.
The general problem is that you either have to increase the length of this phase, or you have to increase the numbers by what you're saying is an unreasonable amount. So you have one way of increasing this phase by making this thing extended, and what's the alternative way to increase the length of this phase?
Well, the alternative is what Natasha said, that it's the mass transfer is stable.
Okay.
Right? Because here, in both of these calculations, it actually does run away. And the consequence of the runaway is that it should go into a common envelope. But if it's stable, Natasha's argue, then the lifetime is the evolutionary time scale on the red giant branch, which will be of the same order as this. So then there's no problem.
The lifetime will be of the my smart and serenity to draw it. Not just the red giant evolutionary time scale. I mean, you cannot exist on that stage more than your reverse of a mass transfer, right?
So
it's less than the
giant. So less than the giant, the time scale in this phase.
Right. And what's the, besides the number, you know, so since they've produced degenerate number densities, what's the critical observation that tells you between these two stable versus unstable lengthenings? Like, is there any other, like, do you see something?
Well,
the
thing is the way to solve that is really by connecting it to the descendants of these systems, because the descendants are double white dwarf systems. Right? So this is what I said at the beginning. I want to try to connect the different types of binaries, and that will tell you that.
So in particular, in the mass distribution of the resultant systems,
yes.
That's the key.
The mass distribution, the period distribution.
Yeah.
That's how you would ultimately do it. So. Or you see one of these systems run away and go into a common embryo. Which has a non-zero probability. Right, so that's actually the smaller problem. The bigger problem is actually the Auber-Pierre distribution. Now, if you use the simple model of stable and unstable mass transfer I was talking about earlier, if you have stable mass transfer, then, particularly if it's conservative, then the system would widen. And if you do this in a population synthesis model, you would get Auber-Pierres that are well above 1,000 days. If you have a common envelope phase, well, then you get the opposite. You expect the system to shrink, and it's very difficult to get Auber-Pierres longer than 100 days, at least in the simple model. So the simplest naive model produces a gap between 100 days and 1,000 days. That's exactly where the systems are observed. So it's orthogonal with the simple expectations. This problem has been known for more than 30 years. John Webbing, I think, was the first one to point that out. And this is actually quite relevant. You see type 1a supernovae mentioned there, because this is one of the channels Ken and his collaborators have suggested is producing type 1a supernovae in old systems. And this is the Auber-Pierres, the companion mass he wants. But in our calculations, we produce very few systems in that island. Now, and some people argue that this argues strongly against this general, but I think that's a very weak argument because, as I just told you, observations tell you that all the symbiotics are exactly there. A particular famous system is ours of Yuki, which has an orbit period of about 440 days, and it has a white dwarf that's very close to the Chandrasekhar mass. We don't quite know whether it's a carbon-oxygen white dwarf or an oxygen-neon white dwarf, but if it's a carbon-oxygen white dwarf, it would be a perfect candidate for type 1a supernova. And we cannot produce ours of Yuki. Not easily. And we have tried.
So, in particular,
Stephen wants to make a comment because he has time.
No, I'm wondering what I should have liked. No, leave it. I was going to ask if you say that common envelope evolution is less efficient than you thought. It seems like that would have the orbits further up. Does that?
I think that's actually the solution. We'll show this later. And this is certainly one of the things that I suggested 30 years ago. But there are some of the alternative solutions that have been proposed. One is, for example, the effect of a circumbinary disk. So if you had a circumbinary disk, then that could stop the widening you get from the stable Rochelle overflow. And we know these systems have circumbinary disks. It's one of the new things that was only discovered in the last 10 years or so. And another solution is that systems, this was suggested by Peter Egerton and Chris Tout in the late 80s, that when these systems get close to filling the Roche lobe, they start to get much higher massless rates, enhanced massless rates, and they called it companion reinforced attrition process, or CRAP. And that's another way of how they can actually avoid the widening and also the dynamic instability. But in any case, so there's clearly something wrong here. Now let's come back, go to simpler things. To understand the binary evolution, we need to understand what drives the mass transfer. It's always determined by the relative evolution of the donor radius and the Roche lobe radius. Now, two things. First, one thing is the evolution of the donor star. The donor star evolves on the main sequence, it will increase in radius, and therefore, at some point, it will fill its Roche lobe, and that can then transfer equal to the transfer of mass. It's very easy to understand the basics of that by looking at the angular momentum. Right, so the total angular momentum of a binary system, the reduced mass, m1 times m2 over m1 plus m2, times the specific angular momentum of the binary. This is mg, square root of g, m1 plus m2 times the separation. That's the total angular momentum. And we now have conservative mass transfer, which means m1 and m2 are constant, and L is constant. You see, that formula tells you that m1 times m2 times the square root of A has to be constant. Or tells you how the orbital separation changes in terms of the initial separation. It must just scale like the inverse of the changes of these products. It's just always directly from that. Now, the product of M1 and M2, if the sum is constant, is a maximum if M1 is equal to M2. So from that, we can qualitatively plot A in terms of the initial separation. And I'm plotting it, the mass in this direction, in good astronomical tradition. The later plots I will show do that too. Right, so this tells you that if M2 is the donor star, and that's bigger than M1, the orbital separation has to decrease. Initially. It reaches a minimum if M2 is equal to M1, and then it expands again. That's the separation. Now here we're interested in not the separation, but the Roche lobe radius. Roche lobe radius scales with A times some function that depends on the masses, but not to very large power. So roughly speaking, the Roche lobe radius has the same qualitative behavior. Okay, so if you have a star, like a Mertensian star, that loses mass, it's now forced to decrease in radius because the Roche lobe radius limits the outer radius. But that radius is less than its equilibrium radius. The star wants to be much bigger. So the star will try to expand to its equilibrium, and it does that on a thermal time scale. So, that expansion itself drives mass transfer. since this occurs on the thermal time scale, you can estimate that m dot scales like the mass over the thermal time scale.
Is that well established? This has driven me crazy because Norbert did some work in 2000 and found like this can be off by like orders of magnitude.
It can be off by a factor of up to 10, I would say.
Okay.
I said thermal time scale. I didn't say which thermal time
scale. Yeah. What mass? Is it the envelope mass?
It's the thermal time scale that's involved in the expansion.
The thermal time scale that gets you the right mass transfer rate.
Right. Okay. This is the simplified version. I mean, we can calculate this correctly.
We can?
Oh, yeah. Yes,
I'd
we
love
can.
To see that. Okay. We should talk. I need to see that sometime.
No, we just...
I could do a computation, but there's no
computation. Yes.
I can figure out how to do that.
No, you can't. No, you have to do a computation.
Okay, I believe that.
Yeah, this can be off by up to a factor of 10.
So it's an appropriate use of the symbol.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, nobody may want to comment on it because you. But we have done the same when we get this command.
Let me cry.
Anyway, the point made, so in this phase, it's the thermal expansion that drives the mass transfer. So once the system widens again, then the system is happy and ultimately can reach whatever its equilibrium radius is. And then the further evolution is just driven by the evolution of the star. So mid-sequence type would just be the nuclear evolution. And therefore, characteristic m dot would be its mass divided by whatever the nuclear time scale. Right, so if you take a solar mass star in the main sequence, take the Kalman-Helmholtz time, that would give you something like 10 to minus 7 solar masses per year here, and something like 10 to minus 10 solar masses per year. The exact number is not important. What is important is that the numbers are very different. Right, and so we refer to this initial phase is the fast, rapid mass transfer phase, and this is the slow mass transfer phase. Of course, since systems spend much more time in this phase, you're more likely to see them in this phase. This is where you see the algols, and this is where you see systems like Beta Lyrae.
What is the system?
Beta Lyrae. What's in the rapid phase? Okay, this picture is important for later. Right. So this is one way of driving mass transfer. It's the evolution of the star. There's another interesting thing. You can also drive mass transfer if you irradiate the star in an X-ray binary, but as I said, this is a thing I will skip today. The other thing, how you can drive mass transfer is not looking at the evolution of the star, but changing the orbital angular momentum of the system. We know of at least two mechanisms of how a binary system can lose angular momentum. One is gravitational radiation, which is well understood. But this only operates if you have very close systems. So if two neutron stars, the system has to have an orbital period less than about 10 hours. And so that gravitational radiation is important. The other important process, it's not so well understood, is called magnetic braking. So if you look at a solar type object, the sun has a magnetic wind, and the magnetic wind is coupled to the sun. A field radius of the sun is about 10 solar radii, which means that the solar wind, even though the mass loss rate is very low, carries a lot of angular momentum. And in the case of the sun, that angular momentum comes from the spin, and that's why the sun is spinning slowly. If you have a binary system, and the star is locked tidally to co-rotate with the orbit, then that angular momentum doesn't come just from the spin, it comes from the orbit. And that's an efficient way of decreasing the angular momentum of a binary system, which then itself drives mass transfer. Except here the details are not so well understood. Natasha has worked quite a bit on this a long time ago. But the overall story here is that if you want to really understand the evolution of binary, you need to be able to account for all the angular momentum in the system. A donor star, the accretor star, any disk if you have it, and in particular, any angular momentum that's lost from the system in a wind. And this is actually now where we come to non-conservative mass transfer, which I think is as important and as poorly understood as common envelope evolution. Because depending on how you lose mass and angular momentum from the system, you can have very different outcomes. The mass loss can be stabilizing or destabilizing. And this is shown now in this curve here. Now I'll plot the Grosslope radius in terms of the initial separation as a function of the final mass. So it's plotted the same way here. The dashed curve shows you what you get for conservative mass transfer. And this is a system that has an initial mass ratio of 1.2. So the donor star is 20% more massive than the accretor. In the case of conservative mass transfer, that's what you get. Initially, the Grosslope radius decreases a little bit. And then after the mass ratio has reversed, it increases. The other curves show what happens if you now have angular momentum loss. And the different curves show you the angular momentum loss if it's associated with different components of the system. Red one is if it's the angular momentum of the donor star. This is what you might expect if you have a giant that itself has a large mass loss rate.
You say the angular momentum of the donor, you mean the spin or orbit?
The orbit, sorry. It's the orbit, orbital angular momentum.
Via the spin? Meaning it's the wind and then the tidal coupling? I guess I didn't
know. No, it's just you have the orbit, right? And the wind has the same specific angular momentum as the orbit of the condenser. I mean, you may also have to include the spin, but that's the high order correction. So this is if it's a donor star. This is if it's a accreting star. For example, if you have accretion onto a neutron star, if the accretion is adding limited, you may expect that most of the mass that's transferred, which can be much higher than the adding limit, would be lost from the neighborhood of the neutron star. And that material would then carry the angular momentum of the accretor. When you see, in both these cases, they lie above the conservative case. So in both cases, mass transfer, the mass loss is actually stabilizing. It changes, and it makes mass transfer more stable than you would get for conservative mass transfer. The third case is where the angular momentum is associated with the orbit itself. So here, it's assumption that the angular momentum has the specific orbital angular momentum of the orbit, which is a squared omega. And now you see that's highly destabilizing. It makes the system shrink just because that the mass loss carries away too much angular momentum. Now, this is a situation that might arise if you form some sort of common envelope, some contact configuration, because then you lose the angular momentum from the outer parts. Now,
this can roll to L203.
Yes. I assume basically here, actually, this is actually even a bit less than L2 nicely in this particular calculation. But
and where we end up on this depends on this m dot that's during the fast mass transfer phase, right? That's very uncertain. Is that right?
This doesn't depend on m dot. It just depends on how much mass you lose. Beta here says that 20% of the mass transferred is lost.
Right, but that is determined by whether or not the companion can accrete the matter.
Sure. That may be, yes, that may be. May depend on that, yeah. Right. that that's what you need to understand.
By a factor of 10, that makes it difficult.
Then?
If that number is uncertain by a factor of 10, that's what we were just talking about. And predicting where we end up on this, which case we end up in, it seems pretty certain.
Yes. But it's, and it's not, this is only because of the rough estimate. We can, if you tell me what the angular loss is, I can calculate it. If I know how much mass the accretor can accumulate, and then the problem, the issue is like what happens when it reaches critical rotation, and then, I mean, Norbert should probably comment on that because he's worked on it. I showed one of your figures earlier. Then when you get critical rotation, you may get a lot of mass loss, and then beta may go to zero.
So what do you depend on observed estimates of the mass transfer rates, or what goes into the models?
You try to model the accretion process. I mean, observations, you can compare the observations in some cases, but, you know, it's not. I mean, for algos, you can compare to observation. Like people have done that, like von Rensbergen, and would try to parameterize it.
Seems like a few estimates of the total mass loss from the system, right? That's a hard thing to measure.
Yes, it is. But it is observed. You see different modes of mass transfer, mass loss. In some cases, you see, I mean, jets, SS-433. But in SS-433, you also see a disk wing. And you need to understand it to get the evolution right. So this is why I'm saying this is, I think this is as important as Kommen-Lambert evolution. But nobody has worked out on this. You might want to comment now. I mean, this is something people often don't realize. But now coming back to the...
Do you at least have a sense of the frequency of these different modes? I mean, to know the relative importance in terms of just the numbers? I mean, do we have a sense of how many, you know, bipolar things versus disky things there are?
Not really.
Maybe a sense of how many stars are actually in the common envelope phase or in this...
I mean, we will, as I said, there has been detailed work on algo systems. Right? So people have tried to sort of calibrate the angular momentum and mass loss in that system just to reproduce the Oberpierre distribution and the mass ratios and so on. So that there is a real constraint there. I've modeled individual systems as well. I, for example, in Alpha Leonis, it's modeled in quite some detail with Sol Rappaport, we find that mass transfer there is probably quite conservative. Well-constrained system, and we need almost conservative mass transfer. So you definitely get variety. And I mentioned down here somewhere, yeah, hot subdwarf binaries, and they to reproduce their properties, you actually need a lot of mass transfer in the system. You cannot actually get observed properties if mass transfers are conservative. So that, I'm saying there are lots of constraints, but there is no, don't have.
Actually, it doesn't sound like, I mean, so it sounds like there's a lot of constraints in individual systems, but yes. It actually sounds like the basic sort of empirical facts are not in place. Which is very exciting, because we can do that.
If you have P dot over P, that's the best constraint. I mean, of course, plus masses. Get a P dot.
Yeah. And for the systems we've got P dots over P, the black electro binaries in the past few years, they've been completely different to what we thought they should be, right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I mean, just for those who didn't follow this, I mean, one of the measurements you might be able to do is the change of the orbital period, the P dot, and principle, the P dot scales with the M dot and the angular momentum loss. And the observed numbers tend not to agree with what we like.
Not by small factors.
Yeah, factors 10, 100, or 200.
Is there a uniform sign of the disagreement?
The p dot tends to be higher.
But of course, there's a selection effect in that, right? Because the higher p dots are easier to measure.
When you do have to be careful, of course, because what are these orbital period changes really related to? What we can calculate are the secular changes. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, if you have magnetic cycles, that can probably introduce p dot variations that have nothing to do with this. So it's so one has to be careful with p dots. Oh. I thought you wanted to say something. That's gone. No, I'm not going to. Tasha will talk about that tomorrow. Right, so that's angular momentum. One other point is what actually happens, really, if you go into a common envelope. Or the star, the mass transfer so high that you form a common envelope around it. And I said earlier, I don't think it's necessarily clear that this leads to a spiral in phase. And this is from a 30-year-old paper I'm showing you here, is the Roche lobe rate. This is the radius of a star, of a 12 solar mass star, that loses mass very rapidly. In this case, it's assumed that the evolution of the star is adiabatic. And you see initially, it's a giant of 300 solar radii. Initially, the radius increases. That's what red giants tend to do. The other curves show the Roche lobe radii for different companion masses, 12 to 6 or 5, 6 solar masses. And these Roche lobe radii were calculated assuming a certain amount of mass loss. In this case, the assumption is that 90% was accreted, 10% was lost, and the 10% were lost with the angular momentum of the orbit. Now, in this initial phase, you see the radius is bigger than any of the Roche lobe radii. This is, some people might argue, indicative of leading to dynamical mass transfer. Does that always happen? And that's not clear. Right? So if the masses are pretty close, and the star only fills the Roche lobe by 10-20%.
So are you also varying the separation of the binary between those curves? Because otherwise I don't understand why a bigger companion gives you a bigger Roche lobe. I mean, if I fix the binary separation, right, and I increase the companion mass, then the Roche lobe of the giant should get smaller if the companion is bigger.
But of course I change the separation.
Oh, okay.
Change the separation in such a way that all of these stars, companions, fill their Roche lobes at this point.
Got it. Yes.
This is the Roche lobe, not the separation. But the point I want to show is, right, so initially there's this phase, where certainly the equilibrium radius, the adiabatic radius, would be much bigger than the Roche lobe radius. But after the mass ratio is reversed, then the Roche lobe radius tends to expand, and at some point, the Roche lobe radius again can be bigger than the radius of the star. So the evolution in this case would suggest that if, let's say, you have an 11 solar mass or 10 solar mass star, that once it reaches this point, it will then follow whatever the Roche lobe radius should be. So in this case, this phase, you would get some common envelope phase, but it could be a temporary thing. Of course, it again depends exactly on how you lose the angular momentum. So if you change alpha and beta, which parameterize the angular momentum loss, the amount of mass you are left at the end varies a lot. But typically, you can have up to a few solar masses of envelope mass left, in this case at the time of the explosion. So this is what we call stripped supergiant progenitors for supernovae. In the modern nomenclature, referred to as sometimes 2Bs or type 2Ls. But this type of evolution also would solve the symbiotic problem, right? Because the systems, the final separations would be very similar to the initial separations. And I think that's what the symbiotics probably tell us.
So for supernova, my understanding is that those partially stripped supernova are not really observed, or you just have maybe a couple solar masses of hydrogen left.
You mean they're not observed?
Not sure I've seen that.
Well, there's, I mean, people have done light curve modeling of, you know, what a supernova would look like if you just had, say, two solar masses of hydrogen left, and it doesn't seem to match very many known supernova. So
you thought it looks like a 2L?
No, it doesn't. Depends on what they have. That's the argument, at least by Tony Pyro, is that it definitely does not look like a 2L.
Mm. Yeah, the 2Bs have like a tenth of the solar mass.
The 2Bs are the...
Yeah, so 2Bs, you lose basically all of it.
Yeah, and you have half a solar mass left also. I mean, it depends on whether they extended 2Bs or non-extended 2Bs.
So if this process is really common, those kind of supernova
should be common. This is not common.
Not
come.
No. Why not?
Because this, in this, for this type of calculation, it has to be KC mass transfer.
Okay, C.
And that's a small range. So the predictions here was that this is only of the order of a few percent, if not. It's not very common. So in that sense, I think this cannot produce the type yet, not in this version. 2Ls are more common.
Why would case B not do something like this? Why would case B not do something like this?
Well, 2B can do the same thing, except, of course, then you start at a smaller radius, and then once you go beyond the adiabatic phase, you have much more time, you have much more radius of it, and so you lose much more mass. And it could still works, yes. But in case B, you would expect much lower envelope masses again. But you're right, case B cannot be. But you certainly don't get two solar masses there. If you just want two Bs, then that might be okay. In fact, I do have models for that with case B. Right, so I should probably finish now. Do you want to talk about wind first level flow? No. Wind first level overflow. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Back to the symbiotic binary.
Yes.
Why do companions? Mm-hmm. The reason why the symbiotic
Sure. But what I was saying earlier is that in the simple model, we don't get the right orbit periods. If you have the mass transfer phase I just described, where the separation doesn't change much, then the problem is removed. You've worked on this, so you might want to comment.
Oh, wait a few weeks.
Okay. Okay, then let me then just show this. This is now Myra. And that's a composite X-ray image, Chandra image. It's a composite of hard and X-ray, soft X-rays. But, you know, very pretty picture. What you're seeing looks like a Roche loop filling object transferring mass to a white hole.
An action picture.
Do you see the right age of the
star?
Oh, this is an actual image of Roche loop.
What's the scale?
couple of arc seconds. That's not what you were asking, of course. Well, global period is larger than 1,000 years.
Well, you give the radius of where.
That's the brochure of radius. Yeah. The radius of Myra is 1 to 2 AU. Yeah. I mean, there it is. But the whole point of this, of course, is Myra is only 1 to 2 AU. The rotor of radius is 40 AU. So what you're seeing is not Myra filling its rotor lobe. It's a slow wind. And you even see a stream towards the accreting white dwarf. Now, at this separation, if you just do a simple Bondi-Hoyle accretion, you would not expect a very large accretion rate. I think what this shows us is a different mode of mass transfer, which may also be relevant for massive stars, is where you have a very slow wind. And the slow wind can feel the Roche potential, and it effectively transfers like a Roche lobe type system. I mean, it's not conservative. There's mass loss from the system. You can also see that in other images. But a much larger fraction than you would expect from simple wind accretion theory is transferred.
Philip, why is Myra so hot?
Oh.
Is that understood?
No. Well, Lars has worked on it. Do you have a view? There are shocks, they're pre-assuming shocks, but the velocities are quite low, and so you wouldn't actually expect it in X-rays.
You're asking about the white dwarf, you're asking?
No, the Myra. Why is Myra visible in X-rays?
Or the Roche lobe of Myra.
Yeah.
But the energy, this is like Pueblo KMB, I suppose.
These will be soft X-rays. In Chandra, the soft X-ray channel.
But is it Myra that's visible in X-ray or wind?
Well, it's the wind.
Okay, all wind.
It must be the wind.
Is this a corona or something of a real giant?
Yeah,
this is 40 AU. Myra is only 1 to 2 AU. It's a small fraction.
Yes, there's something I don't quite understand about this picture, because there's no absolute fast and slow wind, right? It's what's relevant is sort of the velocity of the wind,
sure.
Relative to,
it's the velocity of the wind
at the size of the Roche lobe.
It's the velocity of the wind relative to the orbit velocity, for example.
Exactly. But here, the velocity of the wind is sort of set by the escape velocity from the star, right? So
well,
it's set by the
one
or two AU, and you still have, in order to have a magnitude between the size of the Roche lobe, or the size of the binary, and the size of the star. So the wind is still fast relative to the potential at the Roche lobe.
No, it's not. It's low, in this case. Now, you have to keep in mind, in Myra winds, the acceleration region is actually way above the surface of the star. Right? So you get, you have the Myra pulsation that feed mass into the corona. And then once it reaches a certain radius, you start to form dust. And it's then the dust formation, the radiation pressure on the dust, that then drives the system to infinity. And so the question is, where is the acceleration region? That, I think, is the key factor.
Right. Oh, so you're saying that here it's not just a few times the solar radius, or a stellar radius, I suppose, as it would normally be, because of this dust. Okay.
And the wind velocity in Myra is measured. It's a few kilometers per second. It's very low.
But why do you get temperatures that give X-rays?
Yeah, that I don't want to answer.
Is it thermal?
Pretty high velocities. Yeah.
No, I meant, are the X-rays thermal that Chandra sees? Is it shocks producing non-thermal particles? Because I agree, how do you get
X-rays? I don't know. I don't know the answer.
But the system, could the system be something, I know it's different, but could the mechanisms be similar to what happens in the Ithacar system? I mean, I know Ithacar is not a giant, but there is a collision with binaries.
Yeah, but...
What was the reference for that image?
Chandra, it's Karofsky, 2005. That image is not in that paper. It's produced the data. They have a different image there. But anyway, that's the reference.
But these X-rays are what? 10th
of a kilo?
I'm answering it. Well, these tend to be soft X-rays and these tend to be hard X-rays. It's a composite picture. So that they merge the
which
images.
Which soft X-rays and hard X-rays?
I think this is soft X-rays, not hard X-rays.
Really?
If I remember right.
Soft means... kilovolts?
Probably.
Hard means a kilovolt? Okay. Okay, so to make something that's with a shock, that's a kilovolt, you need velocities on the orders of 1,000 kilometers per second.
Now for the white dwarfs, that may not be a problem. So, but here, for the you need a velocity of 100 kilometers per second, which you don't have.
Yeah.
It's not, you don't have that in the system.
You don't have that.
So I think people have connected with some magnetic activity, but I have not followed that.
Well, there must be a key thing in here, because if the envelope of Myra itself was not so hot, maybe it wouldn't overflow. Temperature is pressure, right? So.
The real problem with that is that if you're using pressure to drive mass outflow, you have those densities, you have a huge amount of radiative losses. It's very hard to maintain the heat or maintain that high temperature. Meaning that the reason why the solar corona goes from being, you know, a few thousand degrees at the solar sphere to a million degrees is because there's basically a thermal runaway. It's really cool because it's very inefficient about 10 spots. But if you were to make the solar corona too dense, it would just radiate all the energy that would be deposited into it. That's why the solar ring can never be more than like 10 minus 14 solar masses per year. Here you're transferring an enormous amount of mass. You know,
10 to minus 7.
Yeah, it's like 5 orders of magnitude, 7 orders of magnitude for the solar ring. So it's very hard to keep that kind of thing pressure driven.
This is an outburst.
That's like a permanent state.
Okay. It's not the permanent state, no.
So this is a temporary transient. I've learned that much so far.
Yeah, not
a super. Already in it? This ring?
From the white dwarf?
Yeah.
They have observations.
No, its the system is too wide. It's far too wide. You wouldn't. Radiation temperature would be tiny.
Is this just a one-off event, or
yes?
Did they have any other observations?
I mean, there are the observations here. There are some infrared observations here, so you see it in the infrared as well. These are infrared observations. You see similar structures here. These are not at the outburst.
What does outburst mean? Is that the bright phase of Myra? Then when it is.
I don't think it's necessarily connected with the Myra phase.
Oh.
It would be natural to expect it. You have the Myra. Myra expands by a factor of 2, and then the envelope collapses again, and you can produce X-rays there. You certainly produce H alpha there. Yes. But you don't see that.
Yeah, that's the thing.
It is definitely extended. It's not a point source.
Do other Myras that don't have a white dwarf companion also have X-rays that vary with time?
I'm not aware of it. You sometimes see H alpha. And that's presumably when the envelope collapses. and then you get X-ray shocks.
I remember about X-rays.
But I don't think it's X-rays.
Yeah, the claim in the abstract is X-rays have never before been detected from an AGB star. Mm. And the recent activity signals that the system is undergoing dramatic changes.
Yeah. Well,
so is the implication that this isn't a normal state?
This is not the normal state. This is absolutely
no, but this is the phase where you can see what's happening. But you can, I mean, we don't know what happens in the other phase.
Is there any way to detect the magnetic flux there? Were there any observations?
I mean, it is connected. I mean, people have argued that as you move with possible, magnetic activity,
we're kind of off track.
I don't think it's observed, as far as I know. I mean, not aware of it, no. I would probably have heard it.
Is it a Kepler object?
No.
I mean, if it's so abnormal, could it be that something very strange happened recently? I don't know, it swallowed a planet or something?
It's not 40 AU in size. Meyer is 1 to 2 AU, you know that.
What has Meyer done since 2005?
Did you have more?
Hmm? No, this is sort of what I would finish. I mean, I have more, but that's interesting enough, right? So.